Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. I'm Don Marsh. If you are one of those people who have not or will not consider organ donations, we have some information for you on today's program that may very well change your mind and dispel some myths. April is Donate Life Month. Tens of thousands of Americans are awaiting organs. There are a lot of lives that can be saved and new techniques that can help. Joining me in studio, Dr. Crystal Lentine, the Director of Living Donation at SSM Health at St. Louis University and a Slough Care nephrologist, Dr. Bruce Bacon, Director of the Center for Transplantation at SSM Health St. Louis at St. Louis University Hospital. Thank you both so much for being with us. Nice to have you.
Thank you for having us.
Do we have any sense, I'll start with you, Dr. Bacon, any sense of the numbers in St. Louis or this region with regard to organ transplantation?
Yeah. So we divide by organs, obviously. So
sure.
Liver's patients waiting in the metro area in our catchment area is around 200 to 250 patients waiting for liver transplant. And Krista and I were talking earlier for kidney transplant. It's about
So the problem for kidney failure is even more prevalent. Currently, there are 100,000 persons on the waiting list for kidney transplants nationally, and that includes 1,300 patients awaiting kidney transplants in the St. Louis area. But it's important to note that even many-fold higher than that are living on dialysis. So part of the message is increasing awareness about seeking evaluation for transplant.
How long is the wait, typically?
The wait for a kidney transplant varies on a number of factors, including blood type and some clinical status to determine medical urgency. But in brief, on average, for an AB blood type, the wait is less than 2 years. And for patients with BNO blood type, the wait in our area is 3 to 5 years. That does vary across the country, and there are parts of the country, for example, in California, where the wait time is up to 10 years. So nationally, it's quite a problem.
Why are kidneys, if I may put it this way, the most popular organ for donation?
Well, if you compare kidney and liver, patients who have kidney disease can have their life maintained with dialysis. Patients whose livers have failed sometimes die from liver failure, and we don't have ways to keep them alive while waiting for transplant. So what we do in the care of patients with end-stage liver disease who are waiting for liver transplant, we rank them by a score called a MELD score. And if you get a high score, you get called for transplant. If you get a low score, you wait. So to answer that same question, how long do patients wait? Some patients wait 3, 4, 5, 6 years. For a liver transplant, some patients wait 3, 4, 5, 6 weeks. So if they get to us with a very high MELD score, they get transplanted quickly. If they get to us with a low MELD score and have to wait until things get worse.
What is the success or survival rate?
Yeah, and I would just love to segue off your question. You asked why kidney transplant is so popular, and I would relate that to the fact that it is just an extremely effective therapy for end-stage kidney failure. So in terms of survival, five-year patient survival is 85% after a kidney transplant from a living person, 75% after a deceased donor transplant, compared to only 40% for patients who have been living on dialysis that long. So kidney transplant both sustains life and improves quality of life. Patients who receive a transplant have better functioning, are more likely to return to work. So it is a superior therapy.
But go ahead, Doctor.
I was going to say the same, pretty much the same numbers for livers. We have a 100% success rate at 1 year. We've done very well. Our transplant surgeons are very capable, and many transplant centers around the country have those wonderful numbers. And then we look at 1 year, 3 year, 5 year survival, and those other numbers are similar to what Chris has said, about 85% at 3 years.
I would think you'd both have to be pretty excited about some of the things that are going on in the field today. I mean,
phenomenal.
With regard to incompatible organs, this seems to be no longer an issue or becoming no longer an issue.
Well, I wanted to speak a little bit about the new data, and I'm sure you're referring to a study that was published in the New England Journal last month on results of an incompatible live donor transplant. And in short, patients who have high levels of preformed antibody in their blood or a condition called sensitization do face unique barriers to transplant access because of the difficulty in finding a compatible organ. The transplant community is very aware of this, and in December 2014, there was some revision to the deceased donor allocation policy to increase priority for these patients. However, nonetheless, many will still wait without a compatible deceased donor offer. So there are a couple innovations in the last few years that have been developed to try to increase access to live donor transplant for these patients. One, which is very important and we promote at our center, is something called paired donor exchange. And in this, patients who have a willing and healthy living donor against whom they're biologically incompatible can enter into exchanges, and there are matching algorithms that are used to essentially swap donors and create compatible combinations. So that can be preferred because it leads to compatible transplantation. But nonetheless, some patients still may not find a donor through that, so they may be candidates for this incompatible live donor transplant, which in short involves giving the recipient treatments to try to remove the preformed antibody and further suppress the immune system to allow an incompatible transplant to go forward.
I was just going to say this is one place where nuances of kidney transplantation are different than nuances for liver transplantation. Mm-hmm. So the liver is a more immunotolerant organ, and we don't have to worry as much about the incompatibilities in liver transplant that we worry about in kidney transplant. So it's appropriate that these kinds of new techniques are being developed for the kidney transplant patient, but we probably won't need those with the liver transplant patients.
Are these only being tried now with regard to live donor donations, if you will?
State of a live donor transplantation is unique in that it allows planning. The treatments can be given in a controlled fashion. These antibody levels can be measured and then allow the treatment to go forward. So that's why it's been developed for living donation. In deceased donor situation, you don't know when a donor is going to become available. Nonetheless, because of this dilemma of these highly sensitized patients not having access, there is some thought given to perhaps giving them desensitization treatment and following their antibody levels. That's not done on a large scale. Incompatible is generally a therapy for live donation at this
point. I'm not sure, Dr. Bacon, we fully understand why this is working. What is going on with this desensitization?
I think you're altering the immune response a little bit so that it's not so vigorous when it gets a big load of something that's not self. Uh-huh. You know, you get a kidney. It didn't come from you; it came from somebody else. So its biology is different, and the natural response is to reject that immunologically. So when you have these desensitization techniques that have been used in place, you don't get that kind of reaction.
This is still pretty much in the testing stage, if you will.
I think it's early on yet. Go ahead.
No, well, the incompatible live donor transplant, it is a clinically available therapy, and this study in the New England Journal reported on a cohort of 1,000 patients who had undergone this treatment. And the important conclusions were that it can save lives. So these are still higher-risk transplants. The risk of rejection is higher than in a compatible transplant, but they found that at 8 years that 77% of patients who had undergone this were still alive, compared with only 63% who remained on the waiting list or received a deceased donor transplant versus only 44% who continued to wait. So higher risk transplants, but can save lives compared to dialysis.
But this has been going on for 8 years or more?
It is not a new therapy. It has been developed, and the innovations are culling the data and raising awareness of its efficacy.
What about AIDS patients? We've been reading also that there have been some unusual progress in this area too.
Yeah, there was a report from Hopkins of an HIV positive patient donating organs to an HIV positive recipient, and that hadn't been done before.
And it's actually a result of a change in legislation. So previously, legislation had prohibited procurement of organs from HIV-positive donors. Legislation went forward. It's called the HOPE Act. And after that has been implemented, these kind of transplants can go forward. Those are high-risk transplants that need to be performed under clinical study protocols, but they're now legal.
So, but we've been doing, or centers have been doing, transplantation of non-HIV negative patients that were deceased, taking those organs and putting them in patients with HIV. That's been going on for quite a while. It's just the fact of using HIV positive organs, donors.
The laws that you speak of that would be regulating this, are they federal laws or are they state laws?
No, federal. So the transplant is a highly regulated field. Organs are a public gift, and there's legislation called the National Organ Transplant Act. And then all transplant activities are regulated by an organization called the United Network for Organ Sharing.
With all of this, what, if any, impact has it had on the number of people who are willing to donate organs?
You raise a great point. So that expanding options for live donor transplantation, incompatible transplantation, use of HIV-positive donors are all really important. But I think really the broader message needs to be to increase awareness of the opportunity for live donor transplantation to the general public. So currently, as mentioned at the beginning, 100,000 persons are waiting nationally on the waiting list for a kidney transplant. About 11,000 deceased donor kidney transplants are performed, and about 5,500 transplants from living donors. But surveys have suggested that up to 1 in 4 people would be willing to help if they knew more about how to do it. So if more people could step forward and consider living donation, we might be able to help this problem.
You're talking about 1 out of 4 people, just plain folks who are willing to give up a piece of their body.
A survey by the National Kidney Foundation suggested that. Certainly that may be an overestimate, but there's a large gap between the 5,500 transplants that are occurring and the number of healthy persons who might be able to help.
I don't want to digress too far here, but is there still a robust industry in selling body parts?
Absolutely illegal in the United States and should be
sure,
illegal.
Right. But it is happening.
It does happen some places in the world, yes.
Okay. Well, we want to talk more about donors and things they can do and things they should know, and we'll do that in just a moment. I'd like to invite members of the listening audience also to become a part of this conversation if you'd like to. We're talking about organ donation. And if you have a question or comment, give us a call at 382-8255. That's 382-TALK. Send us an email to talk@stlpublicradio.org. Or if you would prefer, you can send us a tweet at STL on Air. Back with my conversation with Drs. Crystal Lintain and Dr. Bruce Bacon. We're back in a moment. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. What else is going on? We've talked about the most exciting news. Is there something else we can point to that is an advance from 5, 10 years ago?
Yeah. In liver disease, what's the explosion that's going on is the development of new therapies for successful treatment of hepatitis C. Mm-hmm. So the most common reason that patients come to end-stage liver disease and require liver transplant is complications of chronic liver disease due to chronic hepatitis C. So theoretically, the ability to eradicate virus should reduce the need for transplant as time goes on. So what we have now and have had for about the last 2 years, year and a half to 2 years, is oral therapies without any side effects for just 12 weeks that cure about 95% of patients. Cure. Don't suppress. Don't put in remission. Cure hepatitis C. And we've been very actively involved in taking care of patients with hepatitis C. Our liver group has treated about 2,000 patients and have cured about 1,950 of those patients. So eventually the need for transplant to take care of complications due to hepatitis C will go away.
Right. That's striking information.
That's kind of the ultimate, if you will, the ultimate in treatment is prevention, isn't it, to prevent the need for that. So we still don't always succeed in getting people to not drink alcohol or too much of it, or get patients to lose weight so they don't get fatty liver disease. And then there's a number of inherited and metabolic and autoimmune and other viral types of liver diseases. But the single most one is taking a major hit right now with, mm-hmm. with our successes with hepatitis C treatment.
Well, we only have one liver. We have a couple of kidneys, which gives us a little right. wiggle room, doesn't it?
Right.
Doesn't it?
That's true. And you mentioned it changes, and I just wanted to emphasize at a policy level that one of the biggest change in kidney transplant has been this revision to the kidney allocation system. And I mentioned increased priority for sensitized patients. Another major component of that revision was a change in the computation of waiting time. It used to be that a candidate's waiting time started when they were placed on the waiting list. It was recognized that a better measure of fairness would actually be when kidney failure started or the onset of dialysis or low function. So that revision in policy has, you can have a patient who may have been living on dialysis for many, many years, didn't think about transplant, now comes forward, they're going to get credit for all that disease time. So I really want to encourage, I mentioned 1,300 patients waiting for transplant in our area, many more living on dialysis, maybe who haven't really thought about transplant, didn't think they were a good candidate. So it's a really good idea to talk to the physician. There's evidence coming out that even the process of seeking an evaluation, even if a patient doesn't receive a transplant, is associated with survival benefits, which may just be from the rigors of going through the screening and access to specialty services. So just really want to increase that awareness among patients.
And Dr. Bacon, I'm sure most people don't realize what a burden being on dialysis actually is. Yeah. I mean, it's an extraordinary imposition on one's life.
Yeah, I mean, it's life-saving, but it is a big burden, yes.
Yeah. The therapy you're talking about with regard to hepatitis C, it's an expensive therapy, is it not?
Yes.
Is it affordable for most people? Are insurance companies paying for it?
Well, insurance companies were pretty leery when these medicines first came out. There was the $1,000 pill that was talked about, and it was $84,000 for 84 days, which was the 3 months. What's happened is the pharmaceutical companies that make these brands, there are now three or four different regimens that we can use. And with there being multiple regimens from different companies, there's been competition and the price has come down considerably. The insurance industry, on the other hand, has realized that the price has come down and they've opened access, improved access, so that more patients can be treated. It's estimated that where we are with screening techniques to be able to identify patients who need treatment and the success of treatment, that in about 15 years, by the early 2030s, hepatitis C will be considered a rare disease in America.
Wow. There's a lot of striking information being disseminated here today. What about the Affordable Care Act, Dr. Lincoln? Is that having any impact at all on this whole area?
Well, importantly, Medicare actually recognizes the importance of pain. So end-stage renal disease offers the Medicare disease-specific entitlement. So the problem of lack of insurance or coverage isn't as strong for patients who either need dialysis or transplant. Nonetheless, I think that there's a lot that can be done. Medicare covers the immunosuppression post-transplant for 3 years, yet immunosuppression needs to be taken lifelong. So extending that benefit is something that has been discussed and really needs to be an important policy component.
Right. Well, let's get back to the donor and the need for donors.
Okay.
I know this is Donate Life Month, I think, is what it's called. What do people out there need to know about organ donations, whether they do it as a live donor or not? What do they need to know? What are some of the concerns they have that need to be overcome?
So I've done some work with Midwest Transplant Organization here in town, and I heard recently the actual number of donors has gone down a little bit lately, and we talked a little bit about that at a meeting we were at last night. Some of it is just making patients aware of families of deceased or dying patients aware of the opportunity for donation. There's talented coordinators that work with MTS that participate at various hospitals.
MTS is
what? Midwest Transplant Service.
Okay.
So I'm sorry. We lapse into abbreviation sometimes. Just making those families aware of the gift of donation. I mean, it's a very private and very emotional moment for patients and or for families of patients that are dying. And I think awareness is the most important thing. There's no disfigurement. Patients are patients who are deceased can can have proper burials and all those kinds of things.
It's also very emotional when you hear someone who has received an organ from someone who was deceased.
Absolutely.
You know, and saying the family members saying, Uncle Joe lives on, that right. sort of thing. I mean, that's can be very emotional. What about some of the myths? And there are a bunch of them. And one of the ones that comes to mind is that, you don't want an organ from an old person.
If you don't mind, speak to that on the kidney side. So there is no upper age limit to organ donation. Age does impact the allograft survival. It's part of the computation of deceased donor quality. Nonetheless, many older persons can serve as very appropriate donors, particularly for older patients. On the living donor side, again, no upper age limit. What is assessed is that the patient is in good health and has an adequate level of kidney function that can both serve them after donation and serve the recipient.
But it seems sort of counterintuitive to me that an old kidney is not as good as a younger kidney. I mean, really, that's the way people think.
So there's no limits in liver except for disease that liver patients may have. So a deceased donor, in relative to hepatitis C, again, I come back to that. If a deceased donor has hepatitis C and the recipient has hepatitis C, that transplant can go on because they're still going to have hepatitis C after the transplant, whether they get hepatitis C from the donor or not. And these treatments that are highly successful that I mentioned before are just as highly successful post-transplant. So if you take someone who's got hepatitis C going into their transplant or who gets a hepatitis C-positive liver, they can have their hepatitis C treated 3 to 6 months after transplant very successfully. The controversial area that's coming up is taking someone who is a recipient who doesn't have hepatitis C, and would you put a hepatitis C positive organ in that patient? And some people are saying, yes, we would, because we're so successful in treating the hepatitis C post-transplant, we're not worried about it. We take care of it on the back end.
And this would not have been considered just a very short time
just
ago.
Just a year ago, you wouldn't have thought about it.
Right.
Wouldn't even thought about it.
Right. Which obviously increases the number of potential for
donations.
Transplant donations.
Right, exactly.
Absolutely. What are some of the other things that you think people should understand that they may misunderstand about this whole process? I mean, we talked about myths. You're nodding your head.
Right. Well, just again going back to the living donation side, that there are multiple ways to help. So there are some health exclusions to live donation. For example, the diabetes and then a number of clinical conditions that a patient would need to be assessed for. But for example, if you have a loved one who needs an organ, perhaps you're not medically able to do that. But there are ways to help in terms of serving as a living donor champion, going out spreading the word about the patient's need for organ donation. A lot of the barriers on the living donation side can be the candidates or just have a reluctance to ask somebody to make the gift or scared. So involving another person to help disseminate that message can actually be quite helpful.
Yeah, you don't want people to feel guilty if they say, you know, I really don't feel good about doing that. So patients are not fearful, but they're very cautious in making that ask.
Well, it's quite a commitment.
It's a very big commitment.
To stop to think about it.
Absolutely,
we're talking about doing this oftentimes for strangers, correct?
That is increasing. So donation from unrelated persons actually going up, this paired exchange that I've talked about, non-directed or altruistic donation also going up.
Well, that is good news. What else do you want listeners to take away from our discussion here today? I know there are points you want to make.
I would just say that the St. Louis community is lucky in a way that there are two strong transplant programs, both at Washington University and at St. Louis University. And we have a good cadre of transplantation specialists, nephrologists, hepatologists that can work with the community and the patients to take care of those problems.
Right. Well, that's good. Is there a lot of research going on here as well, or is that being done elsewhere primarily?
Here and elsewhere.
Yeah.
Both.
Yeah, very, very. I would say that both centers are extremely active in research, and our group on the kidney side very active in epidemiology, outcomes, policy-related research, living donated relation research. So.
Did you have something, Dr. Linton, you wanted people to take away from this discussion?
Just reiterating what Dr. Bacon said, we have great transplant centers here, just making the point that patients with kidney failure who may have never considered dialysis, to not make the assumption that they're not a good candidate, to reach out to their center, have an assessment, that patients who may want to help through living donation can contact a center and even consider giving to a stranger, altruistic donation.
The only thing I would say was for referring physicians that have patients with liver disease, severe liver disease, usually cirrhosis and complications, refer early rather than late. Uh-huh. We would much rather see people a little too soon than a little too late.
Right. I imagine there's you have a website, I'm sure, that has information that people can research even more beyond our conversation here today. We'll have a link to that on our website at scopublicradio.org. And while we're talking about this, I have a program note for tomorrow. Nearly 20 years ago, Dana Spencer's family donated her heart to Justin Hughes. Tomorrow, St. Louis Public Radio's Rachel Lippman will share their story right here on St. Louis Public Radio. Thanks, Dr. Crystal Lentine, for being with us. Dr. Bruce Bacon, thank you for being with us from SSM Health, St. Louis University Hospital, for talking about the importance of organ donation. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU.